I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. How do you find out what people want for their city? Sometimes you ask them. John Lewis is the president of Intelligent Futures and leader of Imagine Calgary. Imagine Calgary took a list of four questions out to the citizens of that city to discover what they saw for their future. More than 18,000 residents contributed their ideas. The result is a 100-year vision for Calgary. Now, based on Calgary's success, Portland, Oregon adopted a similar idea. Through the office of Mayor Tom Potter, Liesl Wendt helped create Vision PDX to help shape the future of Portland. Today on Smart City, we'll speak with John and Liesl to learn how looking into the long future is not an impossible reach for cities. All this plus our regular contributors, Nate Berg and Walker Smith, right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Everyone who lives in a city has a stake in its future. Now, normally, planning is in the hands of planning professionals and elected officials, but an innovative program from Calgary found a productive and positive way to find out what citizens want for the future. John Lewis headed the community initiative Imagine Calgary, which developed a plan for a long-range, very long-range, vision for that city. John, describe Imagine Calgary.
Well, Imagine Calgary is the community of Calgary's long-range community sustainability plan. So what that means is the whole community is intended to act on it. So it's not a plan that's just for the municipal government. The intent behind it was that the whole community get behind Imagine Calgary and start to act in more sustainable ways. So the tagline that we used throughout was city-led, community-owned. So we really wanted to focus on the community ownership. The plan was completed in June of 2006. So to date, we have 48 community organizations that have signed on as partners to do their part. So there's a wide range within that. We've got small NGOs with just a few people all the way up to the City of Calgary, the municipal government, which has around 14,000 employees.
Describe the imagination behind Imagine Calgary. What is it that people imagined for their community?
Well, we heard from over 18,000 citizens, which is, from what we understand, the largest visioning process ever done in the world. And people, what we really wanted to pull out was what people value about their community. So here in Calgary, there's a lot of things like the river pathway system. Opportunity was a big thing that came up. And to be able to connect with their neighbors and fellow citizens was important as well. And of course, being close to the Rocky Mountains, that came up quite a bit as well. So a lot of connection to the natural environments. Opportunity, again, was really important to folks, to hopefully maintain opportunity and see those important things maintained through the future.
You talk about community sustainability, and I know in the plan you talk about a sustainable future. What does that word mean in this context, sustainability?
Sustainability really means being connected to all parts of your community. So in the vision, we talk about being connected to one another. So our communities connect to our places. So that means the natural places that we have, and also the places that we build, whether social, cultural, or physical, connected to our communities in a way that they're mixed, safe, and just. And the other important thing is connected beyond our boundaries, which obviously Calgary or any community doesn't exist in a bubble. So to be able to connect to larger regional, national, global issues and trends is important as well. So what we have in the actual plan itself is an articulation of sustainability for Calgary in terms of the basic human needs, in terms of the long-term goals. But then we have targets as well that get more specific that people can start to focus on.
You said you had 18,000 people participate in the process, which I think is extraordinary. It is the largest that's ever taken place. How did you do that? How did you get 18,000 people to participate in developing a vision for Calgary? And what form did their participation take?
There wasn't a one-size-fits-all. It was an important step to that. But we went to a major learning that we had, and we shared that with communities such as Portland in their Vision PDX process, was go where people are. When you're talking about a long-term vision for the community, it's not a pressing enough issue that folks will come out to an open house, which is, you know, the tried and true way of engagement in a lot of planning processes. So we went to where people were. So something like the Calgary Stampede or the Calgary Folk Festival, where people are already there, they're spending time, and they don't mind being asked what they value and what where they'd like to see their community go. We also had more specific targeted sessions with folks that aren't usually in the mix or these types of processes. So seniors, low-income folks, urban Aboriginal groups, that kind of thing. We also did something where we connected with Child and Youth Friendly Calgary, and we had over 40 youth volunteers be trained on the visioning questions, and then they asked community leaders, interviewed them on what they'd like to see. So we had sort of, we called it a generation gab. So in addition, we had telephone surveys and the website, obviously. But what was interesting was that the nature of the questions, which were open-ended, one of the questions was, what do you value about Calgary? It lends itself more to a conversation than it does just plugging something into a website. So I think over two-thirds of our responses out of the 18,000 were in some form of face-to-face contact.
I'm just curious, if I'm at the Calgary Stampede, I wouldn't think I'd be really eager to do some visioning there. So how are you able to capture people in those sorts of big public settings where they're there for another purpose? What was their form of participation? Did you ask them three questions, four questions? Did you ask them verbally? Did they fill something out? I'm just kind of curious how that happened.
Yes. All of the above. We had the five open-ended questions. So maybe I'll just reiterate them so the listeners understand the questions that we had. So what do you value about Calgary? What is it like for you to live here? What changes would you most like to see? What are your hopes and dreams for the next 100 years, and how can you help make this happen? So we had folks that would be at these sessions, and they'd capture people's responses. We'd have opportunities for people to sit down and write them down if they wanted to take that time. And we also had materials like postcards where folks could take it away and give it some thought, and then enter it on the website if they wanted to follow up with that. So again, it's really trying to, when you're trying to get as many responses as possible, as a diverse group as possible, you try and use as many different methods as possible.
You mentioned this 100-year time frame, which I think, again, is pretty extraordinary. How in the world did you get people to think that long term? That seems like a big hurdle to me.
It was, for sure. And that was a bit of a roadblock for certain conversations, because it's just, you know, you're out to lunch, you start to hear, you know, getting conversations about Jetsons and flying cars and that kind of thing. But when you have a chance to explain to people why thinking over the long term matters, people start to get that. So it's not really about predicting the future. It's not about predictability. It's about adaptability. So trying to figure out what we value today, what we'd like to see maintained. So whether that's open space along the river, connection to the mountains, those types of things, and thinking over the long term of how we maintain that. The other advantage of thinking over a number of decades, whether it's 50 years, 100 years, whatever it is you get out of the immediate constraints. So if there's a crisis happening in your community or anything like that, you can get beyond that right now and think beyond that. And the other thing is, you can look at longer term issues like climate change, like energy issues, those kinds of things, and how will those long term trends potentially impact our community. So it's definitely a hurdle when you get thinking out the longer term, but you need a chance to explain to folks in a lot of instances to get them with a sort of level of comfort that we're not asking you to predict exactly what's going to happen in 100 years, but what's valuable that you'd like to see maintained for your children and grandchildren.
Did you ever think about the implications of asking someone who's 50 years old to think in 100 years when actually maybe his or her values would not necessarily be those that the next generation would share? I mean, for instance, there certainly would not have been a very high value placed on what we now know as environmental sustainability 50 years ago, right? We would have thought, well, we can just use all the oil we want, all the water we want, we can discard as much waste as we want, and life will go on. So I'm kind of curious, did you find any emergent values or any values that you thought may be emergent, but citizens weren't naming those values?
It's a good point in terms of evolving values. But if you try and dig deeper, if someone says they want to be able to drive everywhere easily and quickly, then you try and figure out, is it being in their car that they value or being the sort of freedom and mobility aspect? And can that be addressed in ways, again, looking at connections throughout the community? So if we allow people to do that, let's say with the vehicle, what are the connections and implications for other community systems, the natural environment, the built environment, those kinds of things, and really try and see if it's the freedom and mobility, and can we address those in ways in the future that don't have a negative impact on, let's say, the natural environment or how the social life of the city as it pertains to the built environment. So in my experience, there is, what does it matter? I won't be around, that kind of thing. But then you put it into the context of children and grandchildren, and it starts to resonate for them. I think it's, again, about being adaptable in the future so that you're meeting human needs in a way that doesn't cause a negative impact on the opportunity to meet other human needs today or into the future.
What is it that citizens came up with that they have to do? You said that this was a plan not only for government or business or anchor institutions in the community, but rather also a plan for citizens themselves and the things that they needed to do. What were the things that they need to do?
Well, we don't have at this point specific actions connected to our targets. The initial steps that we took and have developed over the last couple of years with the Imagine Calgary partnership is to create these structures and use the organizations as a starting point. The focus and the rationale behind using organizations to start was that if you're trying to shift these community systems, let's say the health system, you're more likely to create change by having the Calgary Health Region with all 25,000 employees doing their part as opposed to a shotgun approach to a million citizens. So we're actually at a point now with the partnership where we're trying to get back out to the citizens. We've been focused sort of at the organizational level at this point. I had a student at this class I teach at the university that I think described it pretty well. She called it sort of a bow tie model of engagement. So if you go left to right, you think of the wide edge of the bow tie on the left side, that's where we were with the 18,000 folks. And then we sort of narrowed a bit as we had more people directly involved in the development of the plan. And then maybe the knot in the bow tie would be where we are now with 48 partners. And it's time to broaden back out and engage more organizations, certainly, but also the citizens in the community as well.
The plan calls for Calgary to become a model city. What is a model city? How do you know it when you see it?
In terms of Imagine Calgary, it's trying to get to the long-term vision and the long-term goals that we've set, so that we're doing things in a way that, again, the back to the human needs, that we're meeting those needs in a way that positively benefits our ability to meet other needs. So let's say how we meet our need for transportation positively benefits folks' ability to meet their economic needs, that kind of thing. So the plan itself, if we get there in Calgary, it's where all these things are connected and people are making decisions in a way that appreciates the connectedness between our community systems. So one thing that was interesting for Calgary is through the organization called the PLUS Network, which is Partners for Long-Term Urban Sustainability, which is how we met up with the folks in Portland, for example. Calgary was pretty early out of the gate, so our experience has been a bit of a model for other communities. So Portland has used some of what we've done, St. John, New Brunswick in Canada, Durban, South Africa with their Imagine Durban process, and they've taken our experiences and our learnings and sort of adapted them for their particular context. So I think with each subsequent plan that comes out, you see more improved processes and hopefully more effective plans.
I'm just curious, what level of engagement do you think it requires for people to feel really bought into a plan? I mean, if I'm at the Calgary Stampede and I answer five questions and I send them, you know, and I do it on the spot and I'm off, am I bought in? What's your take on that?
It's a really good point about buy-in for a plan and that kind of thing. And that's where we're at with the Imagine Calgary partnership. So there hasn't been, you know, a new building that's been built as a result of Imagine Calgary at this point. What's been happening is our partner organizations have been taking the plan and trying to understand what their role is within implementing this plan, understanding it's a community-wide plan. So, for example, the city of Calgary has prioritized for what the city of Calgary's mandate is. They've set those priorities and they've started to integrate them into their three-year business planning process, which is just underway. So that's sort of an example of it takes some time for sure to articulate it and interpret it for a particular organization. So we have the Calgary Board of Education that's taken the Imagine Calgary plan and embedded it into their governance structures. So the superintendent has to report every year on progress towards the targets. They have a role to play. Calgary Economic Development had an opportunity to use it in as a sort of direction setter for their 10-year economic development plan. So it takes, and I think that the process, your talk about process is important because the process provides, I guess, a level of validity for integration into the work of those organizations. And it takes a while and it takes a lot of patience to do that. But I think when you have something as powerful as 18,000 plus citizens have contributed to this, the idea of a citizen mandate that this is what folks are looking for, organizations can feel a bit more comfortable in addressing that direction in their own operation. And that will take some time depending on where they are in their planning cycles and all that kind of thing. I think it's a really good point. You need to find your champions and the people that have the energy to keep running with it. And you need to stay on task as much as possible and sort of build on the enthusiasm of those folks, but also to learn, this is how we tried to embed it in our organization. Here's what worked, here's what didn't, so other organizations can learn from that.
So you're really using the 18,000 people not so much as the champions of the plan going forward, but really as the constituents to encourage your existing organizations to embed this vision that the 18,000 have developed together, to embed that then in their own plans, in their organizational plans.
Yeah, in large degree, because again, the theory behind focusing on organizations was that in their operations, they set a context for individuals to make decisions. So if you think about, I heard a good story from a colleague of mine. He had some friends that had moved from Paris to, I believe, Phoenix, and they had never owned a car. They were transit riders their entire lives, and they were very committed to that in their mindset. They moved to Phoenix, and I think within a month, they had to buy a car because the structure that they were in certainly had an impact on the decisions they made. That's a quick example of the sort of theory behind focusing on organizations, but certainly we need to, over the long term of Imagine Calgary, get back out to the citizens and articulate actions that they can take as individuals to make a difference.
Sure, that makes sense. Calgary, of course, is very resource rich, so it must be thriving now. What are the city's most pressing issues?
Well, with the economic boom came a population boom, and that's some of the biggest, the related struggles in terms of housing affordability, social services, and transportation are the largest issues, I'd say, that Calgary's facing immediately. And in terms of articulating something like Imagine Calgary and why it's beneficial to think long term, you know, you maybe use those opportunities to show the connections between housing issues and economic issues and try and make those connections for folks to show them why it's valuable to keep working on the long term while we have to address some of these obvious short term issues as well.
Well, John, you've done good work. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thanks very much.
John Lewis is the head of Imagine Calgary. For more information and a link to the website, go to smartcityradio.com. For the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
Southern California's commuter rail system, Metrolink, has been in the spotlight since one of its trains crashed head-on into a freight recently, killing 25 people. This devastating crash is a reminder that even trains have their own level of risk. But it also says a lot about the Metrolink system itself, according to Bill Fulton in a recent piece on the California Planning and Development Report. Metrolink is a relatively successful system in Southern California, and it was able to become a success quickly because it didn't build its own tracks. Metrolink shares the rails with freight trains in Southern California. This single-track system severely cuts down on the operational efficiency and safety of Metrolink and other Southern California train systems, according to Fulton. Without a significant amount of public investment to give the commuter train its own set of tracks, Fulton believes that Metrolink's ability to serve the public safely and efficiently will be greatly limited. And just as more tracks means more safety for trains, more bikes seems to mean more safety for bicyclists. Recent studies in multiple countries reveal that as more cyclists hit the road, they are less likely to be hit by cars, according to a recent article from the University of New South Wales. This correlation may come as no surprise to critical mass riders, but researchers are hoping cities will take notice. Some statistics show that if the number of cyclists on the road were to double, cities could expect to see a reduction in bicycle collisions by more than one-third. Interestingly, these improvements in safety seem to be independent from advances in cyclist and pedestrian-friendly infrastructure. But researchers say improved cycling infrastructure probably wouldn't hurt. And finally, a recent piece from the Globe and Mail looks at the election season in North America, both in the U.S. and Canada. It seems that there are some striking similarities between the campaigns. Support for the two opposing parties in each country's election appears to have split along the rural-urban divide. Democrats in the U.S. and the Liberal Party in Canada have attracted urbanites, while the GOP and Canada's Conservative Party have largely appealed to rural residents. This is a change, according to the article, as the American presidential elections of the past were mainly determined by, quote, race-based politics. And in Canada, the primary dividing factor used to be regionalism. But now, the parties seem to be attracting voters based on their locations. Globe and Mail columnist John Duffy says this alignment of geographical ideologies is likely to have a major effect on North American politics during this election cycle, and many to follow. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. After the break, we'll speak with Liesl Wendt. She brought Imagine Calgary's plan stateside and applied a version of the idea to Portland, Oregon. We'll find out what she learned after this short break. You're listening to Smart City. Hi, this is Carol Coletta with a special message for our podcast listeners. Whether you subscribe to our podcast or you have Smart City on a local station but want the convenience of taking Smart City with you on your iPod, we appreciate you. We always like hearing what you think of the show, but we also want to know what's going on in your city. We've had some terrific suggestions from our listeners for guests for the program, so keep the ideas coming. Send us email at questions@smartcityradio.com. Your emails do go to a real person. We read them, and we promise to read them. And thanks again for listening. This is Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Liesl Wendt serves as the project leader for Vision PDX. Vision PDX took Imagine Calgary's plan for developing the long view of the city's future and created a framework for community-led action. Liesl, if you could sum up Portland's vision in a couple of sentences, what would you say?
So Vision PDX was a city-sponsored but community-led project that was initiated by our mayor, but really given permission for the community to lead that effort, everything from designing the engagement pieces of the project to how it was presented to city council.
And how was it citizen-led? I mean, how do you make that work?
That's a great question. That was probably the biggest challenge of the entire project, was really balancing staff and citizen participation. It was community-led. We began with two co-chairs, one who was a dean at Portland State University, which is an urban university in the city of Portland, and the other co-chair worked at the Metropolitan Studies Program at the same university. So they really brought an engagement perspective and a planning perspective. And they really created an atmosphere among our 48-member committee where people's ideas, opinions, consensus could be reached and different ideas could be balanced to actually achieve some outcomes.
Talk to me a little bit more about the role of the academicians. I think it's interesting that you chose a couple to lead this. I presume you did at least select them, right? The mayor selected them?
Correct. We had a competitive process where people could apply to be on the committee, and then as staff went through and selected the committee, but there were several areas where we didn't have very many people who had applied. So from the business community, from academia, from religious communities, and certain minority communities. So we did some particular outreach to those groups to say who could best represent your communities and, probably more importantly, have a citywide perspective when they were doing that. So we didn't want just advocates. We wanted people who could be an advocate, but also look at the bigger city and the future of the city as their participation. So when we went to the university, one of the deans really brought lots of relationships, deep relationships in the community, certainly seen as a leader, was certainly seen as not necessarily having his own agenda for the future of the city, so somewhat neutral, And I think that made it that made a significant difference to have that type of leadership.
What made the mayor take this visioning process up? And it was Mayor Potter, correct?
Correct, it was. And he's just nearing the end of his first and last term as mayor of Portland. He really ran on a notion of community governance and wanting to change business as usual in City Hall. Portland has a rich history of civic engagement, so that part was not necessarily new, but trying to say, how do we get new and different people involved in city government and not just the same usual suspects, which is a term he used quite often. So really wanting to open up the halls of City Hall to more and different people who hadn't had that experience before. And he saw the visioning process as one significant way to do that work.
What do you think he hoped to learn about the community as a part of this process or motivate the community to accomplish?
I think he really viewed it as motivating the community to join hands with local government, with other entities to work on tough issues. So homelessness is one example, schools is another. So how is it that the community doesn't just look to City Hall for the solutions, but that they look to City Hall to help and that they're prepared to walk in step with the city leaders to make change on an issue? Which is a pretty high bar. I think we got there a little bit on baby steps on certain issues. I think that's the challenge for the next administration is how do you harness the energy of a community to work with you and not be looking to you to solve all those issues?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question, that one that, you know, we've been exploring actually through digital technologies. And certainly I think the Obama campaign, forgetting the candidate, but simply looking at the campaign and the methods it's used, has really made digital tools available that then empower people to take action on their own behalf. I mean, according to their own cause and not wait for the professionals to do it. You're trying to do that through this process and what follows. Can you give me an example of where you think you did achieve, as you call them, baby steps, in terms of engaging citizens to work alongside government?
Definitely. I think one thing we did when the vision went to City Council about a year ago, last September, we put in the resolution not just accepting the vision and the background that went with that, but a couple action items that the community had clearly said, we'll work with you, but we'd like to see some leadership on this issue. One of them was creating a multicultural center. So Portland is growing and changing, and certainly the demographics of who lives here and who's coming here is changing dramatically. And there isn't a place in Portland where people can come and just simply gather. There are places to go to get community services, whether that be rent assistance or basic needs types help. There's schools, which is certainly a gathering place, but there isn't a place to say, I'm new to Portland, I'm Bosnian, I'm Somali. Who are the communities that I can connect with and where are the resources for me? So we convened a group that has been looking for the last 6 to 9 months right after the vision passed about what that center could look like and what the different opportunities for funding could be to make that happen. So the city put some key resources on the table to help kind of create the space to have that conversation. And the communities have come to us and helped shape what that ultimate proposal will be. But it was made very clear at the front end, this isn't something that the city is going to bankroll. This isn't something the city is going to take the lead on. This is something that the city will help you get going on. And that has been, you know, it's a new way to present an issue, and so far has been going quite well.
It's interesting. You have a process that began under one mayor, Tom Potter. Now, as you said, he's leaving office. He's being succeeded by Mayor-elect Sam Adams. Is Sam Adams committed to this as well?
I think Sam is committed very much to hearing from the community. I think his style is certainly different than Mayor Potter's. But both mayor and the mayor-elect have been meeting regularly and trying to handle this transition with a lot of grace, if you will, a lot of humility on both sides, and trying to say from Mayor-elect Adams, how can I maintain the pieces that are most important to Mayor Potter, those legacy pieces, and I would say this is one of them, so that they are not lost. More significantly, there's a group of community members who participated in Vision PDX and who aren't just going to let it go. So in some ways, it's exactly what Mayor Potter wanted to happen. I want the community to own this. I want the community to take the leadership on it. I started it, but I've stepped away from it so the community can really take that ownership. So in some ways, he has said to Mayor-elect, this is my priority. I want this type of engagement, this grassroots real engagement to continue. But I'm also going to let the community make sure they hold you accountable to that.
You mentioned a couple of things, a couple of issues that emerged through the process that I want to pursue with you for a minute. One is homelessness. And as a frequent visitor and great admirer of your city, It is disturbing sometimes to me to see the number, particularly of young people who are on the street begging or asking for money, who we would assume, but certainly it's not necessarily the case, but would assume are homeless. What is Portland doing to address that issue?
Portland has a 10-year plan to end homelessness that was created about 4 years ago under Commissioner Eric Sten, who actually is no longer on the city council. And that plan has made some significant improvements. One of the things that it has tried to do is to say, we can provide services such as shelters and places to get food and different things like that. But what we really need to do is to move to a more of a housing first model. So get people into housing, stabilize that most important issue, and then help them with the other issues, whether that be drug addiction, finding a job, reconnecting with a family, whatever that actual issue is. So there's a significant investment by both the city and county for both adults and for youth. There's a significant youth homeless infrastructure here that tries lots of different approaches to engage youth on the streets and help connect them to schools and to jobs and to family.
The other issue, of course, is the multicultural center, and it's interesting to note that, and very close observers and fans of Portland will say, one of the reasons Portland was able to enjoy such great success in recent years is that it was not burdened by the conflicts of race in earlier times, and that racial conflicts didn't enter into the issue of do we redevelop downtown or do we race to the suburbs, do we maintain our city schools or do we abandon those schools. And so race was off the table to a large extent compared to other U.S. cities. It sounds like race or ethnicity is now very much on the table in Portland.
Definitely. And I think the most evident example of that in the recent past is the attempt to rename a street after Cesar Chavez. And that debate really started shortly after Vision PDX went to council in the fall of 2007 and ended poorly. And really that highlighted the issue of more and different people moving into Portland and challenging people's assumptions about race, challenging where those people live and how to incorporate a conversation about race throughout the whole city. It was a very challenging time, I think, for elected leaders, for community members, and as I said, did not end well. And actually, Mayor Potter and Mayor-elect Sam Adams have begun a sort of renewed and hopefully refreshed process to rename a street after Cesar Chavez in a more inclusive manner. But I think it really highlighted Portland's at a bit of a crossroads. So how do we grow through those growing pains that other cities have been ahead of us on, but grow as an inclusive city? And through Vision PDX, I would say one of the main themes we heard was wanting to appreciate our diversity, but we also heard lots of competing ideas around that. People define diversity very differently. People's experience with diversity varies across the city and in different neighborhoods. So it will be a challenge, and we pulled it out through the vision as a challenge in the future. Something people aspire to, but something that's not easy to achieve.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Liesl Wendt from Vision PDX about engaging the city of Portland, Oregon, in the long future of its community. I want to talk a little bit with you about the process, the actual process, because I'd like to hear more about how you thought about this being an inclusive process and what methods you made available to people to participate beyond meetings.
Great. And we really tried to avoid meetings, but we obviously did many, many meetings throughout the process. One of the things that we had available to us, which turned out to be sort of a gold mine, was we had $250,000 available that we used for community grants. And we did a community grants process where we made available funds from $1,000 up to $15,000. And we asked community groups to respond based on how they would best reach their community. So we had some consistent things that we asked everyone to do, the same four open-ended questions that we wanted them to ask of their population or their target audience. But we really put the doors wide open in terms of creativity. So some examples were door-to-door canvassing in a place where people had just come out of prison. And so it was a new experience for them to be asked to be involved in designing the city's future. We had something that was called a kiosk. It was a traveling kiosk that had video and very entertaining way to ask people the questions, and they could either respond via video into the kiosk, or they could type their answers to the four questions. And they were uploaded regularly to a website called the Vision Vessel. And that was successful, not as successful as we had hoped in terms of volume, but it certainly was our biggest media hook that we could use to talk to people about the vision process. We did focus groups with low-income housing residents. We did polling and online surveying with the business community after we had CEOs send out emails to all their employees saying, this is an important survey, please take this. So we tried lots of interesting hooks and tools, whether that be a community leader asking someone to fill out the survey, an exciting way to participate in the survey. One of the other interesting things we did was partner with a theater group who did a very Wizard of Oz-ish play around the future of Portland, and it was an interactive opportunity for people to see a challenge about Portland's future and then be asked to scribble on a piece of paper their answer to that question. How will we deal with low-wage jobs? In the middle of a very funny scene or sketch. And then the answers would be given to the actors, and they would lay them down on a yellow brick road throughout the skit. So that was very creative and interactive. And I think what was different about it was we didn't just hold town hall meetings. We went to where communities gathered. We went to where they were comfortable, and we tried as much as possible to participate in a means that was comfortable for them. So if it was a low literacy audience, it wasn't writing heavy. So it was difficult to incorporate all those answers when you try something in lots of different venues, but it also created lots of buy-in and support for the project because people felt included, not just on the surface, but truly through the act of participating.
Now, how much time did you spend gathering answers to your four questions, and how much money did you spend?
We tried to run the answers to the questions piece of the process a bit like a campaign. So we really ran it from about May through September. And we tried to do it during the summer months when there's lots of festivals and activities happening in Portland, great large gatherings where people naturally were, so it made it a little bit easier. All told through the whole process, so including beginning to end, and that's the outreach, compiling the data, the staff that went with that, some of the marketing tools that we developed, we spent just under $1 million.
And that was all financed by the city?
By the city. We had lots of in-kind contributions, so if I were to add those in, we probably were about $1.2
million. I want to come back to something you said. It's very interesting. You said, we tried not to have meetings, but we had to have meetings. Are you serious about that? You set out not to have meetings?
We did. I am serious about that. One of the things we did a very interesting process. This was really, again, from our community members who said, we don't like to go to meetings, so let's not assume other people actually like to go to them. The skepticism of what actually comes out of a meeting, the time it takes to go, how do you really pitch it, etc. So what they did before we drafted all of our engagement strategies is they did pre-engagement interviews. So they went to community leaders and said, how does your group, how does your constituency like to be involved? Where do they gather? What's your best success at getting a large gathering or meaningful dialogue? And many times it was, we have a meal or we have this event and everybody comes to this event. And so we try to do as many things as we can at that event. Or for business community, for example, online works, especially if the CEO says, please do this. So we incorporated that feedback and then drafted our engagement strategies around that. And certain times, again, you can't really avoid meetings, but we tried not to call them meetings. So maybe it was one of our favorite events was something that took place at the Immigrant and Refugee Community Center. And we had folks from the African community, Eastern European new immigrants, different folks from South America, Latin America, who participated. And people came dressed in their native garb. So it was a beautiful scene of who was there. Many people in the audience did not speak English as a first language. And it was really pitched as, come meet your neighbors. Come meet people who are also new to Portland. That's something that they share. The mayor was at that event. So for many people, that was something that was a draw. There's a lot of respect in different cultures for elected leaders and elders. And people came and greeted him in their own language, and then he spoke and welcomed them and really invited them into Portland's civic process, which again is a bit new for certain people. And then they all spontaneously thanked him in their own languages. And it was a very moving experience and very visually interesting to see all of these new faces in Portland that you don't often see interacting with city officials.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you what the four questions were.
Sure. No, that's a great question. And actually, I know you're talking to Calgary as well, and we certainly spoke with them and learned from their experiences. So these will sound very familiar. The first one was, What do you value most about Portland and why? The second one, what changes would you most like to see in Portland right now? The third, imagine Portland 20 years in the future and all your hopes for the city have been realized. What is different? How is our city a better place? And then finally, as you imagine the Portland you've just described, what are the most important things we can do to get there?
It's a great set of questions. How many answers did you get? How many answers did you have to process?
A lot. We received about 17,000 responses to the question.
Wow.
And many of them were handwritten. Again, we really tried to drive people to the website, but we lucked out on a very interesting partnership with a jobs program, actually. It was called Pivot Job Corps. And it was through one of our staff person's husband worked at this facility. So it was a very interesting connection. And we went to them and said, we have so many paper surveys. We will all pull all-nighters all summer if we're going to catch up with this. What are some ways we could potentially partner? And many of these young women were in keyboarding. And so they needed practice getting faster at their typing skills. And the instructor just bit on this idea. And she said, this is fantastic. We'll take them and we'll do, this is what their typing practice will be all summer long.
Oh, fabulous.
So these young women, we're so proud of the work they did, and we obviously could not have done the project without them. But this is one of those in-kind partnerships that also reflected the way the mayor wanted this process to work, is involving as many people in different ways as possible. And then, of course, as staff, we did pull a few all-nighters, typing the responses to the questions.
17,000 answers to these four questions. I mean, it seems like it would be an enormously rich collection of thoughts and dreams and hopes from the people of Portland. But I'm curious, in the end, cut it all away, is there anything in this vision that you and the mayor, just if the two of you had sat down and written the vision for Portland, is there anything in there today that you think you would not have come up with?
First of all, let me answer it by saying I think the mayor's first answer to that question would be he very much believed the process was part of the product. So there was no part of him that thought that we should write the vision first. There were certainly other city officials who gave me that advice. Wouldn't that be a lot cheaper to do it that way? But I do think there are a few surprises. I think one of the big surprises is that we expected more obvious conflict in where people wanted to go for the future of the city. So I think if we had sat down to write it, we would have painted a few different scenarios of Portland in the future. There were certainly disagreements about certain aspects of where Portlanders wanted to go, but overall, people have a very progressive view of Portland. They like having their elected officials and their community be accessible. They're worried about growth and change, but in a positive way. The consistent theme we heard over and over again is we like the small town feel, but we're really in a city. That plus we like the park system and we like the greenery that exists in the city were probably the two most popular phrases that we heard. And people not wanting to change that as the city grows and changes, so wanting to hold on to those things. I think the other piece that, not a big surprise, but certainly came out very strongly, was this notion of equity. So as we grow and change, we have in Portland a vibrant downtown, which we're very fortunate to have, and a growing downtown. But we also have Outer East Portland, where a lot of the change in demographics, in school populations, the change is really centered there, and it's not prepared to handle all of that in the neighborhood sort of way that the rest of Portland is defined by. So that, I would say, was identified as one of the biggest challenges going into the future, and I don't think we would have given it enough character or understanding had we not done this process.
How do you connect now the vision to its execution?
That's the million-dollar question, right? So we created what we are calling a Vision into Action Coalition, and that was something that we asked City Council to create. We did some outreach to the community and invited people to participate on that. It's now up and running. Similar to what we did with Vision PDX, we have a small amount of dollars for community grants. And what we're doing with those community grants is similar, again, to the engagement. We're saying, here's the vision. You as community members and stakeholders, we'll give you some seed money to start taking action on those action items in the vision. And you tell us best how you think you can do that. So a great example is we have a growing Latino population, and one of the main organizations serving Latino youth closed in the last 6 months due to funding and administrative issues. So it creates a void in the community. So one of the grants we gave is to a group of community stakeholders to say what could a new organization look like and how could that be defined. So the city won't, again, bankroll the organization, but it's bringing people together to define that and give some leadership to hoping that that will happen.
Do older Portlanders, do, you know, your basic white bread Caucasian Portlanders who have in so many ways achieved a great quality of life, do they feel bought into this vision as well? It's interesting to listen to you talk about it. You talk about, you know, in terms of ethnicity or particular sort of niches. I'm just curious, do they feel an ownership of this as well?
The level of participation in the actual vision, I think, equates to people's ownership, not a direct correlation, obviously, but I think it certainly, as if people were participating in the active engagement of creating the vision, have more interest in what happens with the vision. One of the challenges we had in the beginning, and certainly I think we'll continue to have through the Vision into Action Coalition, is we have a rich neighborhood system in the city of Portland that is funded by city government. And one of the conflicts early on was that neighborhood system really viewed themselves as the engagement tool for Vision PDX. And we said, you're one very important one, but we really want to cast the net much broader than it currently is. And that a lot of that is older Portlanders who've been around, who've been in leadership positions, who have in some ways viewed this as a threat, in some ways viewed this as a disinvestment in their system. So there's repair to do. We've really reached out to that neighborhood system. The Vision into Action Coalition certainly has that group as a priority to continue to engage as they take action on the vision.
Well, I think you've done a really important thing, and I appreciate you sharing what you learned with us today on Smart City. Thanks, Liesl.
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Liesl Wendt is project leader for Vision PDX. Finally this week, are your worldly possessions weighing you down? Our City Views commentator Walker Smith has some advice for dealing with all your stuff.
Amy and Jeff Harris of Austin, Texas, have given all of their stuff away to charities in order to homestead in Vermont. As the New York Times reported in a profile about them in mid-May, they are part of the voluntary simplicity movement in which more and more people are opting out of the consumer economy in order to rebuild their lives with as little stuff as possible. Their American dream is to make more of themselves by making do with less, not by owning the biggest house and the latest model car. This is not a big trend, but it is found everywhere, and it's likely to grow as the cost of throwaway goods become ever more expensive. More and more of us are likely to start over in some manner by ridding our lives of the things that consume so much of our time, energy, and money. The challenge in owning stuff is to own it without, in turn, being owned by it. Most often, we simply fail to consider how much of ourselves we invest in the things we own, even how much other stuff we have in order to have all of the stuff we own. Stuff takes time, space, commitment, and not infrequently, worry. The more we own, the more it takes to own it. Indeed, in many ways, things define our lives. It's how we express ourselves. It's how we entertain ourselves and spend our time. It's the basis on which we engage with others. It all revolves around stuff, and let's face it, without this ever-spinning nexus of possessions, our economy could do little more than inch along. Things define every sort of value in our lives. And let's not forget either that material accumulation is a basic human instinct. Civilizations throughout history have been distinguished by the goods that coursed through the lives of those who lived in them. And we believe that we can know them through the material things they left behind. Studying their stuff is how we come to know them, and quite often, the stuff we study is their trash. like the midden heaps of ancient civilizations that archaeologists often study. But is this really all there was to their lives? Surely not. We know there was much to their lives that we can never know through their stuff. So it should never become all there is to our lives either. Yet oftentimes it seems like we are trapped on a treadmill of never-ending accumulation. We have allowed our instincts to become overwhelming obsessions. Even so, giving it all up to homestead in Vermont is not an option for most of us. For one thing, we lack the requisite survival skills. But more than that, we lack the ambition. We are comfortable in our pile of stuff, and we have no interest in making do without it. And this is perfectly okay. Indeed, this isn't even what we need to do to keep the stuff we own from owning us. What we need to do, and really all that it takes, is to make sure that we keep stuff in its place. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. There's more Smart City available online. Get links to our guest work, listen to archive shows, and subscribe to our podcast for extended interviews with our guest. And while you're there, you can sign up for our mailing list and get the latest news from Smart City delivered straight to your inbox. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our former Portlander, producer and engineer. He says Dots has the best cheese fries in the known universe. I'm Carol Coletta.